Matthew 25, starting verse 31. It'll also be on the screens. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father. Take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They also will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison and did not help you?" He will answer, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Then they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. Thanks be to God, the word of the Lord. The story of the sheep and the goats, it only shows up in Matthew's gospel. We're looking at the gospel of Matthew these 12 weeks. Week 10, I believe it is. We're getting towards the end, and it's the sheep and the goats, it only shows up in Matthew's gospel, and it's something of like a climax to Matthew's gospel. Jesus has just arrived to Jerusalem in Matthew chapter 21, and the dominoes are about to start like falling rather quickly. After this parable, there aren't going to be any more parables. After this teaching, there aren't going to be any more teachings in the Gospel of Matthew. The talky-teachy Jesus that we've been following around in the Gospel of Matthew is about to be silenced. I guess the biggest climax of Matthew's gospel is going to come over the next couple of chapters, in chapters 26 and 27. In 27, as Jesus is arrested, he's put on trial, and he's executed, and then surprises everybody in chapter 28 by walking out of the tomb. But this parable right here, chapter 25, sheep and the goats, is a popular one, or not so popular. It's a bit of a climax in itself. All of Jesus' teachings in the Gospel of Matthew, all of his stories, all of theme after theme after theme that Matthew has been including in his Gospel, all come rushing together right here in this parable of sheep and goats. It, like all of the themes from chapter 1 on, chapter 1's news that Matthew tells us that Jesus is God with us, on through like chapter 5, the Sermon on the Mount, the centrality of love, and the truth that the people of God have to be. The true people of God are people of mercy. Remember, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Theme after theme, God with us, centrality of love, you need to have mercy. And then Jesus is right on through Jesus' promise. I'm going to create a new people. The church gets talked about in Matthew. On through Jesus' warnings, particularly for the religious geniuses who have no place for love and mercy in their lives. They're going to be, woe to you, is what Jesus says to all of these themes, all of these threads, all of them start, like, come rushing together in Matthew 25, in this parable of sheep and goats, in this story of separating, the story of splitting, this story of some being revealed as you really are the king's people, you really are the king's true people, and others being told, no, you got to depart from the king. If we just sat down and read Matthew straight through, maybe we did that. Maybe we've just been hitting the highlights of Matthew over these 12 weeks. But if we sat down and read it straight through, this wouldn't be the first time that we've heard Jesus talking like this, using this language of judgment, using this language of fire, using this language of separating. He's warned people throughout the entire Gospel of Matthew, explicitly using the image of fire at least three times in the Sermon on the Mount. And then, go ahead and throw up slide one, Bob. We don't really have time to read through these, so I'm just going to throw them up here. But in the middle of Matthew chapter 13, Jesus tells two parables. They only show up in the Gospel of Matthew. They only show up here. He tells one parable where the world is full of good and evil. It's full of wheat. And it's also full of weeds. But it's not always going to be this way, is what Jesus says. One day, everything evil and everything that causes evil is going to be weeded out. It's going to be forever destroyed. It's going to be thrown into a blazing furnace, is what he says. And then just verses later, Jesus tells another story. It only shows up in Matthew, except this time it's about fish. Good fish story, you know, like you do. The world's full of good fish and bad fish. But one day, the good fish are going to be collected, they're going to be preserved, and the bad fish are going to be tossed. They're going to be pitched into a blazing furnace. This story of sheep and goats in Matthew 25 is not the first time that Jesus has been talking. It's the first time we're engaging it, because it's the best place to engage it in Matthew. But it's not the first time in Matthew that Jesus has been talking this way, that he's talked about separation, about judgment, about fire. And in Matthew's the biblical image, just to let you know, it's not the first time Jesus has been talking about it, and it's not bad news. It's not bad news. If you've ever looked at the headlines, don't recommend it these days, but if you've ever looked at headlines, if you've ever seen a shooting at a nightclub in Orlando, if you've ever seen a bombing at a marathon in Boston, if you've ever seen like violences and injustices out there and you're like, good God, something's wrong with the world. If you've ever said somebody should do something about this, these stories is somebody doing something about it. That's what these stories are about. These stories are not bad news. These stories are good news. Even these stories of like separation and fire are good news. Is Jesus assuring us in stories like this, good is going to win the day. Good is going to outlast evil. Evil will be taken care of. Evil's going to be dealt with. But this story, let's talk about sheep and goats for just a second. This story right here, it's a bit troubling. Has anybody, I may be the only person who's thought that the sheep and goats is a rather haunting, disturbing parable, but it is. I would suggest if you are not disturbed by it a little, if you're not haunted by it just a little bit, you really don't care. That's okay. Like, well, let's just call it. But like, you're not really listening to what Jesus is saying. You're not really listening to the story that Jesus is, you're not really taking Jesus seriously. That's okay, that's the effect that this story has on us if we take Jesus and we take the story seriously. This story is similar to these two stories that Jesus has already told, but there's a twist this time in the sheep and the goats. It's a little bit of a twist, because this is a story of separating, of judgment, of fire, where nobody winds up where they thought they would. Am I right? Like, that's the story of the sheep and the goats. It's full of surprises. It's got no easy answers. everyone, literally, everyone in the story is surprised. That's the disturbing part about this parable. It might be the most disturbing parable Jesus has ever told. The sheep don't know they're sheep. Verses 37 through 39 says, "When did we see the king? When did we do any of this? Feed or give water to or come and visit? When did we do any of this for the king?" And verse 44, "The goats don't know they're goats. We didn't ignore the king. When did we not care for the king? What's going on here?" In this story, some of the people who thought they were out are actually in. And some of the people who thought that they were in are actually out. In a way, I think that's unlike any other parable that Jesus tells. You walk away from this parable like a little disoriented. You walk away from it like a little lightheaded, a little dizzy or something, a little disturbed. There have been, this is just me leveling with you, there have been seasons in my life, a handful of seasons in my life where this parable has like really gotten to me, like really disturbed me, where I've walked around for weeks at a time or months at a time, and I've had this parable like rattling around somewhere in my brain. And for most of those times, this parable devolves, it becomes, what it ends up becoming in my brain as it's rattling around is a question like, okay, how do I confirm my reservations for the afterlife? It's kind of what I feel when I read this parable. I'm like, whoa, wait a second. Because it's the worst feeling in the world, right? To get to like a hotel or to an airport or to like somewhere like that and to be surprised, isn't it? "I'm sorry, sir. We don't see your reservation here." It's a terrible feeling. Back in April, perhaps you guys remember this like a monstrous surprise blizzard hurricane thing that came barreling over the Rockies all of a sudden one weekend in April. Joy and I were actually in Georgia visiting family, and I got an email, and it turned into a whole thing at the airport. But like, I got this email saying, "Surprise! Your flight back to Denver has been canceled." Some people talk about getting upgraded on flights. I've never experienced, like, they get to the airport and there's a surprise. "Surprise, you've been upgraded." It's great, you get first class or something. I've never experienced that. As far as my personal experience, including back in April, goes with reservations, any kind of like surprise that I have with reservations usually goes in the direction of like bad news rather than good news. "Surprise, we can't find your reservation." "Surprise, your reservation has been canceled." And this story from Jesus is so haunting. The sheep get upgraded to first class, but I've never really experienced that myself. I kind of identify in this sheep or in this story with the goats. Like these people who like, "Surprise, your reservation. I don't find your reservation here." And showing up for the afterlife when the Son of Man appears on his glorious throne, that seems like one place where I don't want to have any surprises, doesn't it? That seems like one place where it's like, it matters if my reservation can't be found. It really matters. So for me, personally, this is just my angst with this story of Jesus. I tend to start like looking in this story like in for details and asking myself, okay, this is such a surprising story full of no easy answers, but yeah, how do I confirm my reservation? How do I confirm it? How do I, like, is there a 1-800 number I can call? What can I do details-wise? I start noticing that the sheep and the goats get separated. They get separated on what basis? Whether they prayed some prayer and walked down an aisle, whether they got baptized. No, that's not what the story says. The story says that they get separated based on how they cared for the least of these, is what it says. Verse 40 and 45. And so I latch onto a detail like that, and I say, okay, who exactly are the least of these? Who exactly are these people? Because I need to make sure that I'm treating them, whoever they are, I need to make sure that I'm treating them really, really well, you know, to confirm my reservation. Is Jesus talking about children? Children in need, you know, literal least of these. They're small, children are. You know, the smallest. He's welcoming children to him throughout the gospel. Maybe I need to make sure that I'm just meeting the needs of children. But it's hard to say for sure because, you know, in verse 40 he says, the least of these brothers and sisters of mine is what he says. And that makes me like, okay, maybe he's not talking about children. Maybe Jesus is referring to what he talked about in chapter 10 and what he talked about in chapter 18, where Jesus had actually called anybody who follows him the least of these. The disciples, Christians are the least of these. Remember Peter does the impossible with little faith? Peter is got little faith. He's one of these little ones is what Jesus calls him. So maybe the least of these, maybe to reserve my reservation for the future, maybe I need to make sure that I'm treating Christians well. Or maybe Jesus is talking about anyone, anywhere, who has any need. That's, after all, the way that most of the church throughout the centuries has interpreted this particular passage. So maybe I need to make sure that I meet the needs of everyone? Everywhere? That's a tad overwhelming. Like, how does that work? Like, what if this month I go visit someone? I go visit someone in prison, in the prison of their sickness, in the prison of their loneliness. What if I go visit someone in prison made of actual metal bars? But then what if next month life's a little overwhelming? School started. What if I can't do it next month? Like, which one counts and which one doesn't? Is the king going to say, is he going to count last month? Or was he looking at last month, or is he going to look at this month? What if in August I take a meal to someone, but then in September, I'm lucky if I'm feeding my own family. You know what I mean? Like, how does this work? What about all those people, like when you drive into a parking lot near Applebee's or Best Buy or something, you know, those people with signs standing on, you know, they've got signs, and sometimes they've got like babies with them, and they're saying, I need food. I need money. Is that the king that I'm driving by? And like, one day I'm going to find myself a goat that I didn't stop as I was pulling out of Chili's and give them some food. I didn't get order takeout for them or something. Because most of the time, I just keep driving. Granted, I am literally spoon feeding my 6-month-old daughter right now. I am giving food to a small one, at least of these. But am I, this story haunts me, am I doing everything that I can to help those poor people who have been reduced to holding signs in a Best Buy parking lot? You know what I mean? What counts? Because that's really what I'm concerned about. I'm not really concerned about them. I'm really concerned about me. One day, is my reservation going to get canceled? You know, I need to confirm my reservation. But, and this is the disturbing thing, the seasons that I've walked around with this story rattling around in my brain. If this is about scorekeeping, if this story is about scorekeeping, I'm pretty sure I've let too many people go hungry. For me, personally. And then, that moment that I've been scouring the details of this story, trying to figure it all out, I've been trying to crack the code, and the minute that I feel like, okay, I've cracked the code, I figured out what number I dial to confirm my reservation for the afterlife, I've figured out whose needs I need to meet, and what I need to do, and how much is enough, this parable ends up coming around the backside of me and biting me again. Because the entire point of this parable is Surprise! That's the whole point of this parable. As far as like confirming our reservations go, trying to make sure that there are no surprises go, as far as all that goes, this parable is a complete bust. It's no good. It's a complete bust. If we make this parable primarily about fear in the future, about confirming reservations for somewhere else one day, it's got almost nothing helpful to say to us. But I don't think that Jesus is primarily aiming at the future in this parable. I don't think that's even his point. He's not concerned about instilling fear in the future by telling this story. He's concerned about something else. He's concerned primarily about instilling faithfulness in the present. Not fear in the future, faithfulness in the present. This parable is aimed at the present. When Jesus talks like this, when Jesus tells stories like this, he's using language of like fiery judgment in the future. But he's not talking in a vacuum. Jesus didn't just show up in a vacuum one day and start talking like this. No, no, no. Jesus is standing in continuity with. He's standing in a long line of prophets, is what Jesus is. He's standing in continuity with the ancient prophets of Israel. And the prophets of Israel were not primarily concerned with predicting the future. Never. Read them. The prophets were never concerned with predicting the future. Sure, they'd talk about it sometimes, but the prophets of Israel were primarily concerned with the present, with what you're doing right now in the present, with calling people to faithfulness right now in the present. A few weeks ago, we mentioned it just really briefly in passing that in Matthew 16, Matthew's the only gospel writer to include a little detail. The only gospel writer to say, maybe this Jesus, word on the street is, maybe he's Jeremiah. I think that's Matthew cluing us in. Jesus sounds a lot like Jeremiah. If you want to understand what Jesus is talking about, read, get familiar with the prophet, get familiar with the Bible. Get familiar with the Old Testament. Slide 2 is an example of what Jeremiah sounds like. I could have picked a lot of places. Jeremiah 17, though. Jeremiah 17, verse 4 says, "Through your own fault, you will lose the inheritance I gave you. I will enslave you to your enemies in a land you do not know. For you have kindled my..." This is fire language. "You have kindled my anger, and it will burn forever." Verse 5. "This is what the Lord says. Cursed, goats, cursed is the one who trusts in man and draws strength from mere flesh and whose heart turns away from the Lord. That person will be like a bush in the wastelands. They will not see prosperity when it comes. They will dwell in the parched places of the desert, in a salt land where no one lives. But blessed is the one..." Blessed of my Father, come take your inheritance. "Blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. They will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit." He goes on in verse 24 and makes this comment, "If you are careful to obey me," right now, in the present, "if you will obey me, this city will be inhabited forever." Verse 27, "But if you do not obey me, then I will kindle an unquenchable fire in the gates of Jerusalem that will consume her fortresses." That's the way Jeremiah sounds. Kind of language that the prophets use. Sounds like Jesus, doesn't it? When a prophet
like Jeremiah talks like this. He's painting with like really symbolic, poetic language. Not because he's interested primarily in predicting the future. What he's interested in is, what are you doing right now? He's interested in changing the present. And some of this language is deliberately, verifiably, exaggerated language. If you take verse 4 of Jeremiah 17 absolutely, woodenly, literally, then it's not true. It's demonstrably not true. God's anger does not burn forever against his people. It does not burn forever against his people. Decades after Jeremiah, God's going to rescue them from exile in Babylon. Eventually, God's going to go as far as becoming one of his people to save them from their sins. If that sounds familiar, it's the beginning of Matthew's gospel. God's anger does not burn forever against them. When Jeremiah uses that kind of language, when he says that God's anger is going to burn forever, he doesn't mean that God's going to hold a grudge. He's going to nurse a grudge against his people forever. No, no, no. What he's saying, he's using language to say God is super serious about what you're doing right now. It's super serious business what you're talking about. The language of verse 27, I think it's still up here, of verse 27 in Jeremiah, it wasn't meant to be read in a flat-footed, wooden, absolutely literalistic way. How do we know this? The city of Jerusalem is not still on fire. Right? It's at some point, the fire was quenched. At some point, that fire went out. It wasn't literally unquenchable fire. When Jeremiah uses the language of unquenchable fire, he doesn't mean that it's fire that literally, like you throw water on it and it won't go out. No, he means, this is just me trying to read the Bible. What he means is that people won't be able to stop what's coming. You're not going to be able to stop what's coming. You're not going to be able to quench what's coming. God's judgment is coming. The language is white hot. It's fiery kind of language. And it's meant to convey the seriousness of what's at stake. The images of like burning forever and fire in the future one day, they aren't Jeremiah's primary point. When he's talking to people, he's talking about something more serious than fire. This isn't just fire. This is more serious than fire. Jeremiah is invoking every possible, like all of the strongest images and language that he can muster, because he's trying to speak to people's hearts right now in the present. The imagery isn't always predicting exactly what the future is going to look like. For Jeremiah, this fire came in the form of a foreign army, of the army of Babylon. For Jesus, this fire is warning us about existence apart from God. Can you imagine? Why would you choose a life apart from goodness and truth and beauty? How injustice? What in the world? And yet Jesus' language is warning us about that. But for both of them, for Jeremiah and Jesus, the fire isn't primarily about instilling fear about the future. For both of them, they're trying to get us to be faithful in the present. The point is, how will I live? How will we live right now? Will we choose blessedness to be like a tree planted by the water and live true life right now?
Will we choose that? Or will we choose a cursed kind of life? A life in the wasteland? A life without thriving? We won't see prosperity. Jesus is not telling this parable so that it will rattle around in my brain and that I will to instill fear in me or anybody else about the future. He's not trying to get something to rattle around in our brain so that we'll worry about confirming our reservation for the afterlife one day. Jesus is telling that because the parable doesn't work on that level. It's a bust. Jesus is telling this parable. Matthew is including this parable as a bit of a climax for us so that we will choose a particular kind of life right now. Jesus is telling us a parable like this to make us dizzy. He's trying to haunt us. He's trying to disturb us. But he's not trying to get us to start keeping score, tallying up how many people we've passed in Applebee's parking lots. You know, that's not his point. The good news, in case you were fuzzy, the good news of the gospel is that God has, that God's anger did not burn forever. God has become one of us to save us from our sins. He's done it before we ever gave him a thought. The good news is that God already always loves us. He's already at work saving us. That's the gospel. We're never going to save ourselves by doing anything, by feeding anyone, by visiting or clothing anyone. That's never something that's going to save us. It's never something that's going to the reservation is already confirmed, is what the gospel says. The reservation's already confirmed. God is always the one who saves us. But with a story like this, and this is going to lead us to the table. With a story like this, Jesus is telling, he's maybe telling the most disturbing parable ever. And he's cutting to the very heart of the matter. He's cutting to the very heart of our lives. Jesus, we said this at the very beginning as we started studying Matthew. Jesus is wanting to make sure that we're not fooling ourselves. Be really careful that you're not fooling yourself. It's really easy to just hear people talking about Jesus, to hear the story that Matthew's telling, but never really commit ourselves to the narrow road that Jesus is calling us down. To never really be, no, I am from the depths of my soul, I am in. I am with that guy. I will listen to him. I will follow him on that narrow road. It's really easy to not do that. And so Jesus tells us a really disturbing parable. A story about sheep and goats. About rewarding the king's true people. Surprise, you're the king's true people. And about fiery judgment for those who choose to live with no interest in mercy. People who have no interest in loving other people. He tells us this disturbing parable about Emmanuel, about God with us. All the themes of Matthew are rushing together right here. And that God is with this world more deeply than you can imagine is what this parable says. He tells a story to get under our skin. Not so that we can be fearful about the future, but so that we can be faithful in the present. Jesus is warning us about something far more serious than fire. I kid you not. Far more serious than fire. Jesus is warning us that it is possible to miss him. It's possible to miss it. To miss God. To miss the King. To miss the meaning of life, to live in such a way that the heart of the universe will have to say, depart from me. You really never wanted anything to do with me. You never really wanted anything to do with me. Slide 4. I think this parable saying something like, if we care nothing about actually helping others, about love, about mercy, then we care nothing about actually being with Jesus. We care nothing about being with Jesus in this life or any other life, is what the parable's saying. It's not possible to care about the king and not care about the people in this world. It's not possible. If we care nothing about actually helping others, we care nothing about actually being with Jesus in this life or in any other life. This parable is the place where we realize, like, the full ramifications of the good news of Emmanuel. The good news of Christmas. The good news of Matthew 1. The good news of God with us from chapter 1. God is with us. He's with all of us. The entire world. Slide 5. Down to the very people that we consider least. God with us also means God with them. God with us also means God with them. It doesn't matter what we know. It doesn't matter what we have prayed. It doesn't matter what aisle we've walked down. It doesn't matter what rules we keep, what kind of religious geniuses we are, if we are not caring for them, for others, if we're not actually doing it, like practicing love and mercy, then we're not interested in the king. We're not interested in Jesus. We're not interested in the narrow road. So as we come to the table this morning, maybe we should just have a moment of asking ourselves, who is the least? Not so you can confirm something for yourself later, but so that you can love and participate in loving the King right now. Who are the people? Maybe it's a group of people. Maybe it's an entire people group. That's called racism or xenophobia or something like that. Maybe it's somebody that, like, just their very name bristles something in you. Who is the least? That person you've written off. That person around you who's hurting. That person we hate. Did you know that God with us is with them too? Emmanuel's with them too. God with us is with them too. And loving them, us choosing to love them, actually practically doing something, like picking up that phone, having that conversation. Maybe it's just writing that note. Giving your time, giving your energy, giving your money, whatever it is, you're actually serving the King. You're actually participating in real life right now. With the least, whoever that is, what would it look like for you to love them? What would it look like for you to serve them? What would it look like for you to have mercy on them? Because until we're actually willing to do something, to actually do it, to actually love and serve and have mercy on those people around us, on those that we consider least, we're not interested in actually being with Jesus in this life or in any other. So may we be counted as sheep when the King comes and not just lookalikes. May we trust that God's already always saving us, and He will on that coming day. And may we choose to enter into that salvation every day until then. And may we feed the least, clothe the least, visit the least, because God with us is with them too.